This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Coming up a little bit later, how do you think your email gets from here to the UK? I'll give you a hint. It's not a satellite. We'll talk about the hidden pipes that connect the global internet. But first, a quick roundup of this week's science stories. Rachel Feltman is here. She runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Here with a few of her picks this week. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, what's at the top of your pick?
So at the top, we have a bunch of really exciting astrobiology news this week. First of all, NASA had this panel where their lead chief scientist, Ellen Stofan, said that we will find evidence of life within the next 10 to 20 years. Now, of course, she means little green microbes, not little green men. But it's still really exciting to hear someone from NASA come out and make that kind of declaration. And it's because they're realizing that there's water pretty much everywhere. You know, people used to get really jazzed about the possibility of ancient water on Mars. But now we're realizing there are bodies within our own solar system that probably have water right now. Jupiter's moon Ganymede, Europa. And we're talking about going on a mission to Europa looking for life in these subsurface oceans. And apparently NASA's starting to feel pretty confident about it.
Now, it's turning out that the moons are more interesting than the planets themselves.
Yeah, that does seem to be true.
All right, let's talk about, you had something about ingredients for life found among young stars.
Yes. So there was a study in Nature this week that for the first time, astronomers found complex organic molecules in a protoplanetary disk. So that's the area around a new star where all of the dust and gas is gathering and will eventually form planets. And we know that in our early solar system, the protoplanetary disk must have had tons of these organic molecules that go on to build amino acids and proteins and are necessary for life as we know it. And now they've spotted that in another new star system. So we may not be that special, which is really exciting. And what's cool is that they weren't even looking for these molecules there. They looked with ALMA, this giant radio telescope that's starting to get some really exciting information. And they found these specific molecules kind of by accident. So it's possible that we're going to find lots more.
Well, we put that water together with with the molecules that they're finding.
Right. Who knows?
And you can see why people are excited. They used to say we're in such a special neighborhood for life. It's turning out we're not that.
Right.
Such a special neighborhood.
Yeah.
Next, what's another spacey related story?
Okay, so I have some moon news. So it turns out that the formation of the moon is still kind of a big mystery to a lot of scientists. They've generally come to the consensus on something called the giant impact theory, which is that the moon was formed when a planet about the size of Mars hit Earth, and that most of the moon's material came from this other Mars-like planet. But what's unusual is that the Earth and the moon have really similar chemical compositions, and it shouldn't be likely that a random planet that came and hit the Earth happened to have exactly the same chemical composition as the Earth. So the question is, how did the moon that was formed from this planet that came out of nowhere turn out so much like the Earth? And there were three studies in Nature. One found that it's actually slightly more likely than we thought that a random planet could happen to collide with a planet that had the same chemical composition. I think they put it at around 20 to 40% likelihood, which was way higher than what people had thought previously. And then the two other studies looked at they analyzed the tungsten in the moon and the Earth, and they came to the conclusion that what might have happened was that when the Earth collided with this other planet, it was such a strong collision that all the material swirled up. The Earth was still partially molten, so the materials became homogenized before the moon got to form. The problem is that no one understands the physics of how that would work.
Oh, details, details.
So they're both interesting steps towards a better understanding of the moon, but both require a lot more understanding before we can say they're what happened.
Did they know, they have an idea which planet it was that might have crashed in? Because there's a story, was it last week, week before, about Jupiter ping-ponging inside around?
Right, that Jupiter probably obliterated this whole mass of super-Earths that existed before us. This is a planet that's usually called Theia, and you know, it was basically destroyed because most of it went on to form the moon. So it's not anything that we'd recognize as a planet hurling around space right now.
Theia, good science fiction name for a planet. Okay, what else do you have on your list?
Well, let's see. There was a great study looking at these three species of tiny crustaceans that have evolved to lose their eyesight because it's useless. They live in deep sea caves. There's no light. They don't need to see. And researchers basically looked at their brains and compared them to seeing relatives to try to understand when they had a common ancestor who could see and how their brains have changed since then. And they found that the parts of the brain that deal with sight have actually very quickly atrophied. When I say very quickly, I mean over a course of about 200 million years, which in terms of evolution is pretty quick.
Yeah, I was quibbling with that.
Yeah. So it turns out that they've pretty much gotten rid of the parts of their brain that are used for sight, while touch and smell have stayed the same or even gotten better.
Wow. And you also have a quirky science.
Yes, I do.
A lot of men are going to be interested in hearing.
Right. So it turns out that a cure for baldness might be literally tearing your hair out.
Good.
Precisely.
There's hope.
Basically, researchers plucked hairs from the backs of mice, and they found that if you pluck hair in a small enough area, it makes the follicles around the plucked hair activate as kind of an immune system response. The follicles send out a distress call, and it extends to the follicles around it. So they were able to pluck out 200 hairs and get 1,300 to grow back in their place, I think. So very preliminary and on a mouse. So people should probably hold off before grabbing the tweezers. But it's definitely interesting and certainly quirky.
Yeah, well, you don't want to, you don't know which hair you, because it has to be a certain hair. It's not
right.
All the hair.
Right.
They're plucking them all out.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is something, as they say, it's not ready for prime time.
No, not yet.
They've got to study this a little bit more. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel, it was great to have you. We'll have you back soon. Rachel Feldman is a science writer, runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Time now to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. After a 2-year break for upgrades, the world's biggest physics machine is finally coming back online. Last weekend, scientists sent the first protons whizzing around a newly souped-up Large Hadron Collider. You'll remember the last time scientists turned on the LHC, the world's biggest, baddest proton smasher. They were rewarded with a nifty prize, the Higgs boson, the linchpin of the Standard Model. So what's left there to find? What new particles are out there for this round, Season 2, and how long until those groundbreaking discoveries get made? Here to share the good and the bad is BBC science reporter Jonathan Webb. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira. It's nice to be here.
So the LHC is back. What's good about that?
Well, yeah, as you say, it's big and it's back and it's better than ever. So the physicists who work there are kind of impatient. They've been waiting 2 years to get their proton beams back, and they're all very excited to start smashing things together again, which all starts next month. And as you say, they've not just used these 2 years to sort of go through and check all the magnets that steer these protons around at nearly the speed of light and to make sure it's all working properly. They've improved it as well. They've been through a big upgrade, and this time when the collisions happen, they're going to be happening with twice the energy that they've ever had before. So it really means things are wide open. As you said, the last time they switched the thing on, they had a big target out there. They knew they were hoping to find this thing called the Higgs boson, which is the particle or the field that gives everything else in the universe its mass. And they were pretty confident they were either going to find it or they were going to sort of find that it wasn't there. Sure enough, it was there, and the Nobel Prizes, came soon afterwards.
So
this time, it's wide open, so they don't know exactly what they're going to find. But the big, big questions are up for grabs, because these new energies are going to take matter to places where we've never seen it before. So we might start to see signatures of things like dark matter or supersymmetric particles that physicists kind of think are there, but we've never actually seen.
Yeah, so it's wide open. It's just like we don't know. It's like a new frontier. Something could pop out.
Completely, yeah.
So
yeah.
What's the bad thing then?
The bad thing is we're probably going to have to be patient. Everyone's excited just to get the beams, you know, back up and running in the machine, but the collisions don't even start for at least a month. That's when they'll actually turn the beams, you know, funnel them into each other inside the four big experiments that run there. And then the job really begins, if you like, and the physicists have to start going through the data. And there's a lot of data. I mean, there's a reason that the guys at CERN, where the LHC is, invented the internet, and it's because they deal with, you know, terabytes, petabytes, whatever, of this, you know, the detections, the data that flows out of these great big experiments, and it takes a long, long time to go through them. From like back when the Higgs was discovered, it took at least a year from the first kind of signs they got before they made a public announcement, and then there was more work to be done even after that. So even if they do find new and exciting particles, I think we'll be lucky if we hear about them this year and probably even next year. But like you say, it's wide open and we really don't know, because matter's never been taken to these states that we're going to be seeing in the LHC since fractions of a second after the Big Bang.
Is it possible they'll find nothing? And how long would you go looking to give up, to throw your hands up?
That's a very good question. And the physicists would like to, I mean, they've promised. They think they're pretty sure they're going to find some pretty amazing and spectacular things that we haven't seen before. But yeah, there are no guarantees. And in terms of specific things, you're right. You probably do have to set a time limit on it. There's a popular theory in theoretical physics called supersymmetry, which proposes a bunch of extra particles that we haven't found yet, some of which might account for things like dark matter that we know are out there but we've never seen. But so far, none of these proposals have actually borne any fruit. So people are beginning to say that maybe time's running out for that sort of field of proposals, those supersymmetrical ideas. So maybe if we haven't heard anything about those within a year, people will start to maybe give up on them. But then theoretical physicists are very good at coming up with new ideas.
Yeah,
so
they
never
run out of ideas, and never less than an infinite horizon for them. Thank you. Well, the message is be patient, Jonathan, right? We'll be patient.
I think that's the best way to go forward, yeah.
Jonathan Webb is a science reporter for the BBC News. Thank you, Jonathan. He joined us from London. Coming up, we're going diving in search of the undersea cables that drive the global internet. Yes, there are pipes on the internet. We're going to find them. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Arctic sea ice is at record low levels as of March. And as you've probably heard, all that melting ice has sent energy companies swarming north in search of untapped oil and gas. But that melting ice is also changing our global communication network, allowing for the installation of a fiber optic cable linking Japan to the UK, all over the top, going to travel over the top of the world, under the ocean there. And when it's done, beams of light will zap data from one end to the other in just 154 milliseconds. And yes, that is faster than the blink of an eye. But don't get the idea that this cable is unique, because over 300 underwater fibers already stitch together global communications. Cables that link continents and countries, they string together islands and archipelagos. I guess the internet really is a system of pipes. My next guest traveled to the world, around the world, tracing that hidden web behind the web. She joins us here in our New York studios. Nicole Staroleski is an assistant professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU, author of The Undersea Network. And we have an excerpt of the book on sciencefriday.com/underseanetwork. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Staroleski.
Thank you.
Okay, tell us about this book. We're familiar with the wireless internet, Bluetooth, and all the invisible data links. But you write in the book that despite the rhetoric of wirelessness, we exist in a world that is more wired than ever. All those pipes now?
Yes, that's right. So even though we usually think about the internet as kind of wireless in the cloud, we use all sorts of metaphors of the air to talk about it actually goes through cables, fiber optic cables underground and undersea. So 99% of transoceanic data traffic, internet traffic, goes underneath the ocean on the very bottom of the seafloor.
Well, but Dr. Staroleski, that's puzzling, because why don't we have all these satellites and things? Why do we still have to send the stuff under the sea?
Right. Well, it's more efficient to send it undersea. If you think about it, to send something via satellite, it has to go back, like up into the atmosphere, through all of the clouds, back down. It's a much greater distance. So it takes about 8 times longer to go via satellite between, you know, Europe and America than it does by cable, right? Cable, you're tracing the globe and you're going at the speed of light. You have a channel that's unencumbered by environments, or it's been made so by the cable industry.
So would you say that the bulk of internet traffic then goes through cable someplace?
Yes, that's true.
The bulk of all of it?
Yes. It goes by cables. Usually the wireless step is the last hop, right? Huh. On your phone, on your laptop. That jump then enters a massive cabled, wired infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. But, and are they stringing new cable all the time, this project?
Yes, yes. There are new cables every year. Yeah. And there have been cables across history, even during the satellite era. Every year there were new cables.
Let's talk about the technology that allows them. How do you string a cable, a new one? It's a long distance. What's the technology like?
Well, you drop it off the back of a ship. You know, this technology.
Thank you very much.
You know, there have been advances in the technology, particularly in fiber optic technology. But in cable laying, the basics of that technology were really set up in the late 19th century. You know, they developed these huge cable ships. They have these big tanks inside the cable ship with enough room to wind up a cable that can go across the entire Atlantic Ocean, right?
Wait a minute. Wait, one ship?
One ship.
You need one ship for all that, 3,000 miles or
yes,
whatever?
Yes, you can do that with one ship.
Wow. And so how thick is the cable? I mean, it has to be pretty strong, right? Cable has to be made specifically for being underwater.
Right. Yes. But it's about the size of a garden hose or a
That's
beer
it?
Bottle cap.
No,
yeah.
No kidding.
When they come ashore, you have to protect them from humans, which is the most dangerous part of the cable route, right?
We are always in there.
We are always in there, yes.
Dangerous animal on the earth.
Right. So you have to put them in, you know, a metal conduit then. But on the bottom of the seafloor, as it's going through those ocean trenches, it lays kind of bare, exposed, only the size of a garden hose.
Wow. So do they ever, you know, once they come up offshore or the tide goes out or something, do they ever show bare? Can you see the cables coming ashore?
You can see them in the conduits, right? So in Guam, for example, the cables run right over the shoreline. You can see the conduits, but they're not marked. People step over them looking for, you know, the tourist attraction down the beach,
right,
and have no idea that the internet is pulsing right underneath their feet.
You highlight a couple of instances in your book where natural disasters or careless people were able to take down the internet.
Right. And it's most often careless people. So I think there is between 1959 and 2006, 60% of cable faults were from ships' anchors or fishing. And since then, there's reports that that has increased, right? So the majority of the disruptions of our undersea network come from people dropping an anchor off their boat and hitting the cable, or a fisherman dragging a net on the bottom of the seafloor. That is the number one biggest concern.
So how much of the internet do you take out when you take out a cable like that?
Depends on where you are, yeah. Right? So if you're in the U.S., you know, we have a lot of links, right? Maybe 50 or so, like, you know, links. If you're in Vietnam, where there have been a number of cable disruptions over the last decade, there are two points where the internet exits via undersea cable, right? So there was an incident where in 2007 where the government had said, okay, well, you know, fishermen, go ahead and pull up old cables, basically. This is what it reported, some of the old cables that were copper. But the fishermen started pulling up the new cables and shut off a good portion of the internet for Vietnam. There were delays up to 3 months afterwards.
Wow, wow. And so cables are breaking all the time.
Yeah, there's about 200 cable breaks a year.
200?
200.
Are they all repaired?
Yes.
So you go
pretty
in?
Much all of them are repaired,
but
yes.
There's enough redundancy in the meantime.
There is. For most locations, there is redundancy, but not all. And there are a number of really critical pressure points where, you know, natural disasters, anchors have taken out good portions of the, you know, communities, yeah, nations from the internet.
Well, you visited the many cabling stations around the world where the cables come ashore. I imagine if I were a terrorist looking for a target, I just look where the cable's coming out.
Right, yeah.
How vulnerable are they? Are people watching them? Or if people are tripping over them and digging them up with their garden, you know?
Right,
they seem to be very exposed.
Right. Well, the cables really haven't been a target for terrorism. Some in the industry speculate that this is because they're not a visible target, right? A cable goes down and people's internet gets a little bit slower. So this doesn't seem, there often aren't necessarily reports about mm-hmm. what has happened. Mm-hmm. There are a few kind of, you know, instances where it did get reported as potential terrorism. One is an example in off the coast of Egypt in 2008 when there were a number of different cable breaks in succession. This looked very suspicious. You know, the reports were that it's just ships that had dropped anchors, but there were no videos of ships. There were no records of the ships. So then there was a lot of speculation. Was this a terrorist attack? I mean, it cut off something like 60 million people in India, 12 million in Pakistan, 6 million in Egypt, and 4.7 in Saudi Arabia, one of the sets of these cable breaks. But you couldn't kind of pin it. You couldn't. Right. There was no accountability for it. You couldn't weave it into a narrative about terrorism.
No one took any credit for it.
Right. Yeah. And so these haven't really been a site for a terrorist attack, although there are certainly people who are worrying about the fact that our cable network isn't, you know, totally diverse, and there are these critical single points of failure.
Mm-hmm. But in case you just joined us, we're talking with Nicole Staroselsky, who is author of The Undersea Network. It's a really interesting book about all the, not just transatlantic cables, but cables all over the world. You can read an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/undersea network. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also call us, 844-SciTalk. What surprised you the most? I mean, you got to uncover stuff that you said, hey, wow, I didn't know that when you did research for your book.
Right. Well, one of the things that surprised me the most was the longevity of these systems, right? They are built to remain on the seafloor for 25 years. And the old telegraph cables, some of them lasted 70 years underwater, right? These are some of the most inhospitable environments to humans, right? Mm. The very bottom of the seafloor. Today, they've constructed repeaters, you know, amplifiers to boost the signal intermittently. Right. So these are essentially like technologies that are devised to stay on the seafloor and operate and carry our internet traffic, and they function for 25 years. What else, you know? What else of the internet has been instituted and stayed the same for 25 years,
or would?
We would imagine that.
Yeah, and the British had to solve this problem: how to insulate the wires. You're in salt water. You know, you need a lot of insulation. And they came up with a material called gutta percha, which I thought they made golf balls out of earlier.
Right.
You know? So what did that do for them?
So, yeah, that was the biggest, you know, some people writing at the time when these cables were first developed said the biggest challenge was insulating the wire from the water, right? Because otherwise the signal would just disperse out into the ocean. This wasn't a problem for terrestrial lines because air just insulates copper wires. But gutta percha, which was tapped from Malaysian trees, kind of a sap rubber that then was used as an insulation for these cable systems in Malaysia and in Singapore, because the British were able to develop that and had a monopoly on that material, that helped them to develop a monopoly over the whole colonial network.
Are there still ancient gutta percha cables?
Oh, they're all over the ocean.
They're still working.
They're not working per se, but they're strung all over the ocean still.
If you wanted to go see one of these cables, now we have a lot of listeners across the country, around the world, and they're saying, "Hey, I want to go see where one of those cables comes out." Got any recommendations where one easy to see one might be in the East West Coast somewhere?
In the U.S.
Yeah.
Let's see. In the U.S., I mean, the thing is that they're fairly well hidden here, right? So I can direct you, you know, or you can look up. There's a, you know, a number of resources, you know, cable maps online.
Oh, is that
where
right?
You can go see.
Of course.
Yeah. So there's a great research firm, Telegeography, that has a lot of information about undersea cables. Another great resource is this organization, the International Cable Protection Committee, and they're really dedicated to, you know, preventing these many disruptions. So there's a lot of data online, but you would go and you would see, like, this kind of unmarked industrial building, right? And you wouldn't actually see in the U.S. the cables go ashore. So you could go to these beaches listed on these sites. You know, there's a lot of cables that go out through San Luis Obispo. There are a lot right around New York here, a lot just north of Miami. You can go stand on these beaches and think, the internet is going here underneath my feet. But it's hard to see anything because you see just these industrial buildings that look like any other infrastructures.
That's the way they like it.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about this Arctic Fiber Project. Why do we need that link if we already have so many of these cables?
Right. Right. So Arctic Fiber has pitched, I mean, I think it's a really unique project. We've never had a cable that has gone through the Arctic Ocean, a transarctic cable. And so they pitch it as it's going to be the fastest cable.
The short distance, right? You go over the pole.
The shortest distance, right. So they have, that's important for like high frequency traders that could capitalize on, you know, being able to know, you know, with computational systems.
Always for Wall Street.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it would be the fastest route between London and Tokyo.
Right.
It also has a kind of development aspect, right? So Arctic Fiber would serve all of these northern communities along the Canadian and Alaskan coasts, as well as potentially the high Arctic Research Center mm-hmm. that's being developed there and oil companies that seek to drill there, right? So there are all these people who are really invested in developing in the Arctic. But it's not really a feasible... You know, you might ask, like, why, if we have so many links, yeah. would I buy capacity on this cable yeah. route? And the answer really is diversity, right? Because our cable network is really concentrated in specific spaces.
Right.
And then that makes it vulnerable on the whole. But it's always cheaper just to go where everyone has gone before. There's already a station. You already have route maps. You know where yeah. to go, yeah. right? So who's going to pay the extra money to develop the new route that makes the network overall more resilient.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Nicole Staroselsky, author of The Undersea Network on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. And does the NSA or anybody else have a way to tap in to these undersea cables?
Yes. I mean, that was one of the things that was revealed in the Snowden leaks, is that the NSA and the GCHQ were tapping into undersea cables at cable landing stations. And this actually has precedent. If you look back in history, there is a U.S. military operation called Operation Ivory Bells. Ivy Bells. And what they did is they tapped a sea cable, a Russian sea cable, on the sea floor mm-hmm. and put in a 20-foot-long kind of intercept, probe on it. Today they're called intercept probe, but they basically read all of the communications data that was flowing through that cable. And people, because the Russian thought that this was such a secure route, running it through the cable rather than through the air where it couldn't be intercepted, they didn't encrypt a lot of their communications. So it was a great source of intelligence until the operation was sold out by an NSA employee.
Right.
So this has precedence, and in 2005, there was a report that the U.S. had developed a nuclear sub capable of tapping fiber optic cables, although this is unconfirmed by the U.S. government. So it is certainly possible, and it is done, and it is spurring new kinds of projects like Arctic Fiber or a new cable between Brazil and Portugal that route around the U.S. in order to avoid that monitoring.
Do you have to actually puncture the cable to tap it, or can you non-invasively?
I'm not exactly sure what the technology is, but my sense is that I do think you do have to, I believe you have to puncture it.
It's light, because there's light in there.
It's just light.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that exactly.
We have some callers who want to know if the sea cables, Ricky Bevington said, do the sea cables hurt sea life or the environment?
The impact on sea life is relatively is next to nothing for undersea cables. I mean, they're very small for in terms of all of the things that we are doing to our oceans, right? Like throwing plastics in it, drilling oil pipeline. Like there are all these things,
it,
right? So there are tons of things that are going on in the oceans right now. The sea cables, because they go down for 25 years. And then they don't really get touched, you know, it's not...
And it's big as a garden hose, you said.
It's as big as a garden hose, right? So the impact on sea life is relatively little. The biggest part might be if you have to dig a trench through, like, a coral reef, they don't really do that anymore. Like, that probably wouldn't happen for environmental reasons, but it did happen in the 1950s, so... Mm.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff about cables, you know. One cable ship can lay the whole thing in one...
Yeah.
Wow. Nicole Staroselsky, excuse me for butchering her name. Nicole Staroselsky is an assistant professor of media culture and communications at NYU. She's author of The Undersea Network. Great read. Thank you for being our guest today. And if you want to read an excerpt from her book, it's at sciencefriday.com/Undersea Network. When we come back, Lauren Good from Recode is here to decode the Apple Watch. News on the internet said today, the Apple Watch was introduced today, and they sold it out within hours. There's one report that sold out. Some models sold out in 10 minutes. So we'll talk with Lauren Good after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My next guest has spent a week with a new gadget strapped to her wrist. And you can probably guess what it is. The Apple Watch. Orders being taken as of today. And she's taken calls with it, sent texts, gone cycling, paid for groceries, and checked in for a flight. Well, she tried to check in for a flight. Well, she'll tell us all about it. Lauren Good is a managing editor of reviews at Recode in San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Nice to chat with you again.
Yeah, thank you. So give us your impression, of the new Apple Watch.
Well, my initial impression was that I had an overall very good experience with the Apple Watch. In fact, in my column on Recode.net, I say that of all of the smartwatches that I have tested over the past few years, that I feel that the Apple Watch experience was the best that I had. But I do feel that, maybe it's not for everybody. You have to have an iPhone 5 or newer in order to use the watch. And for some people, they may even be just so far off from considering a smartwatch that it's not necessarily the Apple Watch that's going to tip them over the edge.
Did it stop you from having to check your phone all the time? Because it relays all those messages. You don't have to take your phone out. Maybe you can serendipitously look at it when no one's watching at dinner.
In some instances, it meant that I did not have to check my phone. If I was really busy, I didn't have time to pick up my phone, I was in a meeting, like you said, I would get notifications on the watch, such as iMessages. I could see an iMessage and respond to it from the Apple Watch. And I could see glimpses of emails, or at least find out when I was getting a new email. But it didn't replace the phone entirely, because while you can respond to iMessages from the watch, either using a shortcut or using your voice, you can't respond to emails. And some of the third-party app experiences are pretty limited as well. So in a lot of instances, I still found myself reaching for the phone and picking up the phone when I really needed to do something.
Tell us about something that did not work out so well, checking in for a flight.
Well, I had just gotten my Apple Watch Loaner. I'm wearing the stainless steel 42-millimeter watch. And I was flying back to San Francisco, and I thought, let me try loading my boarding pass into Passbook, because Passbook runs on the watch. And so I'll just be that person that goes up to the gate, and I'm going to stick my wrist under the sensor, and I'm going to go through that way. So I had everything ready to go. I looked at my watch. The boarding pass was ready to go. And I walked up, and I couldn't fit my wrist under the scanner. And the woman at the gate was very kind, and she said, and she sort of noticed what I was trying to do. And she said, try again. And I said, okay. And so I stuck my wrist in at a different angle, and I said, this is just not happening. So then I had to dig through my bag and find my phone and pull up the boarding pass that way. And, people were waiting behind me, and they must have just been thinking, okay, this is kind of irritating.
Yeah. That'll teach you to be a fashionista. So. it just wouldn't read it because it was, these
things. No, it was more just it wasn't that it wouldn't read it. It was just the way that the scanner was built, and that, it can fit something like a flat piece of paper, or can fit a thin smartphone under there, but I couldn't actually fit my wrist with the watch under there. So it was just, I guess, a matter of logistics, less than the technology.
Did you get a lot of stares? People, watching you with the only one with the watch, wondering what's going on?
I did, actually. A lot of people noticed it, which surprised me. When I was on that same flight, a man was coming back to his seat and happened to look down at me and said, "Is that the Apple Watch?" really loudly. And then he was so excited that he spilled his bottle of water on me. So that person,
hopefully not on the watch, right?
We missed the watch, which was great. It just was on my pants. But when I said, "Well, thank you for avoiding spilling water on the watch," but I couldn't really hide at that point because I was just, stuck in the middle seat. And then, I was out in public, and one man waited until I emerged from a restroom and said, "Is that the watch?" And so people were very, one person said to me, "Is that the iPhone watch?" It was kind of funny to hear some people call it the iWatch, some people call it the iPhone watch. So it is noticeable. But as I said in my column on Recode, I got the sense that was more about the fact that it was this unreleased Apple product out in the wild that people are very excited to see than it was about necessarily a pure aesthetic appreciation for, look at that beautiful watch. I think if it hadn't been the Apple Watch, maybe people wouldn't have been quite as intrigued by it.
Was it annoying to have to take it off and charge it up every night? I've had my watch on for 10 years. I don't think I've taken it off. Would I be put off by that? No, I have an underwater watch, so I don't
know. There you go. Some people might be. I think that if you are accustomed to having to charge your smartphone every night, then it just sort of feels like that. It's just another thing to charge. My issue wasn't necessarily that I had to charge something every night because I'm already charging lots of gadgets at night. My issue was that I thought the inductive charging solution, which is sort of like, it's like a traditional Apple charging cable, but at the end of it, there's like this little disc and the watch magnetically attaches itself to that. I didn't really like that as much because it was very easy for the watch to become disconnected from the magnet. And so I thought, well, there could be maybe be a little bit more of an elegant solution here, maybe like a little charging cradle that the Moto 360 smartwatch has. But otherwise, you know, I think expectations were set with this. We heard a little while ago that the battery life maybe wasn't going to be so great and that people might have to charge it every night. And so that was just the experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's been pointed out that when you look at your wrist, it's sort of a cultural cue, like, oops, I got to be somewhere, you know? Whoops, I didn't remember I had an appointment. It's sort of, I want to stop what I'm doing and get out of here. Is this going to be a problem? People looking at their wrists all the time and giving out the wrong cue about, oh, no, I'm just looking at the email that came in, you know?
Well, as my colleague Liz Gaines wrote recently in a piece, I think the looking down at your watch is the universal, I'm really bored with this conversation sign. And so it can be kind of rude. In fact, about a day after I got the loaner watch, I was wearing it in a meeting and I had forgotten to silence the Apple Watch. So it just kept pinging and pinging. And finally, the person I was meeting with looked at it and he said, you know, that's a little bit distracting. And so I think you are going to see people starting to look at their smartwatches more, but I don't think that that means you should necessarily break the rules of etiquette. There are definitely some instances where you do not, maybe you're on a job interview and you don't want to look down at your watch when it's pinging. In fact, you should just silence it.
Are you going to get one? Can I get one?
I think my plan is that I'm going to purchase the sport model because I'm really interested in using this for health and fitness purposes. I've done a little bit of that this week. Actually, I've done a fair amount of working out with it this week, and I'm planning on doing a lot more of that and writing about that more for Recode next week. And so my goal is to buy the sport one and really use it for health and fitness and kind of, you know, see how well it does and just really put it through rigorous tests.
Well, we'll be reading along with your writing, seeing how it works. Thank you, Lauren, for taking time to be with us. Lauren Good is
chatting with you.
You too. She's the managing editor of reviews at Recode in San Francisco. Since 2008, we have produced hundreds of short videos, from food physics to galactic collisions to cryptic octopuses. Maybe you're one of these 6 million people that have gone online and watched one on our website or downloaded on our app. Well, today we are thrilled to announce a new way for you to enjoy Science Friday. We're introducing the Macroscope. It's a weekly online video series. We're aiming a cinematic lens at the true stories from scientists and innovators, their labs and their creations, and perhaps changing the way you view scientific research and discoveries. Our video producer, Luke Groskin, joins us now to discuss the debut episode of our new video series. Hello, Luke. What do you have under the microscope?
Hi, Ira. Today? Well, we're starting.
Congratulations
on this. Well, I'm proud to present the first episode, which is starting at the beginning, a developmental beginning. It's called Babies on the Brink, which is all about babies and their fear of heights.
Babies' fears of heights.
Yes, that's right. Babies.
Did you actually make them walk the plank of fear of heights?
No babies were harmed in the making of this video at all. These are professional developmental psychologists at NYU's Infant Action Lab. They're trained in the art of baby wrangling and catching. And yes, they did put babies on ledges
to see if they were afraid they could detect the ledge. I remember the visual cliff, as they used to call it back in the day.
Yes,
and we actually showed this on Newton's apple in the 1980s. That was a really famous experiment.
Yes, exactly. It's a really famous experiment conducted in 1959. And here is the psychologist we profiled, Dr. Karen Adolf, describing what that looks like.
There was a very, very famous classical study in developmental psychology that showed that human infants and infants of a number of different species will avoid crossing over an apparent drop-off from what they called a visual cliff. It's a glass table, and on one side, there's a checkerboard pattern surface right under the glass. The other side of the table, the pattern surface is way down on the floor. So visually, it looks like a big 3-foot drop-off.
And yet they're not showing any signs, you say, of fear of that visual drop-off.
So here's the thing with the visual cliff. This was an experiment originally made to test depth perception in mice that had been kept in a dark room. Mm-hmm. And they put all these other species on there. And they noticed that when babies that hadn't learned to crawl yet, they just crawl right over the ledge. Like, they don't care. Now, the babies that had learned to crawl, they avoid going over the drop-off. So they go, okay, so they're avoiding going over the drop-off. They must have learned to fear the heights. And so they go, okay, so they're avoiding fearing the heights. So they're avoiding crossing because they're afraid of heights. They're afraid of heights. How do we know that? Well, they're avoiding crossing.
Right.
And you notice what I just did there. It's a big circular argument.
Right, right.
And so that's where the myth came from, that babies are afraid of heights. But, you know, that's not necessarily what's going on. If you look at the babies themselves, they're putting their hands over, they're putting their mouths on the ledge. They're really fascinated with the heights. They don't seem like they're scared. I mean, as a parent, you know when a baby's scared. Yeah. They don't seem scared at all.
They actually put the baby on the edge. Without the glass, there was actually a cliff there.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you take the baby and you put them on the side where it looks like they're just on a piece of glass, their heart rate goes up. But again, they don't seem like they're scared. They don't seem like they're showing all the facial signs of actual fear.
So you have to catch them if they want to go over. Well, catching the baby is very important, right?
That's how you test that's how you do a real test. Real test, which I actually filmed at NYU's Infant Action Lab, they put a baby on a real ledge or an actual slope. And they do this with hundreds and hundreds of babies. They vary the degrees of slope. They vary the height of the ledge. And they see exactly what's going on they try to figure out exactly what's going on in these babies' minds. Mm-hmm. And what's really, really fascinating is that the baby that's 8 months old that hasn't learned how to crawl yet or is just starting to crawl, they just walk right over the ledge or they walk right over the steep slope. The same baby, a month later, they avoid it. And then a month later, when they stand up and they start walking, they walk right back over again. And then a month later, they stop doing that. They avoid it. So what are we witnessing here? We're witnessing learning. Not fear. We're mm-hmm. witnessing three different or four different learning curves in the development of these children.
Mm-hmm. Myra Flato, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Luke Ruskin to talk about the debut episode of our new video series, Under the Macroscope, talking about the visual cliff and babies. Now, I mean, the babies are reacting when they're on the cliff, and so how do we know that they're actually happy or whether they're afraid, making all these noises?
Oh, you can totally tell that they're having a good time. I mean, this is of all the labs I've ever visited, this was probably the most joyful lab I've ever been in. Here's a little sample of what it sounds like.
Oh, that's cute.
Everybody is very happy in the lab. Everybody is just excited to be there. And I can tell you, you know, if I had known that I could bring my kid to a developmental psychology lab where they could have fun, I would be signing him up for all sorts of tests. He'd be a guinea pig immediately.
So when they go over there and they make those squeaks and sounds, those are joyful noises. What are they learning? What are they getting out of it?
So that's the big question. What is actually going on there? So what they're basically doing, all these learning curves, is they're learning the limits of their body. Now, in psychology terms, this is known as affordances. They're just, what can I afford to actually do? So, for example, if you go outside if I told you to go pick up a car, you go, you think, no, I can't pick up a car. Yeah. That's crazy. You're not afraid of it. You're not concerned with your ability to do it. You just know you can't do it. So, I mean, what they're actually learning is what their bodies are capable of. What are they actually able to do? So they know they can't climb over the cliff. They're not scared of it. They just know they can't go.
Yeah, yeah. How do we get this myth wrong all these years?
When I first heard it, I was like, well, that makes sense. We climbed out of trees. We shouldn't be able to actually get away with not being afraid of heights. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, it makes more adaptive sense to actually be not fear heights.
Actually, the adaptive thing is for children to explore new situations and to learn as much as they can. And happily, you know, they have caregivers who are going to be there, standing there, so that if they went, too close to the edge or they were trying something that was impossible, they could be rescued.
Hmm. And so on evolutionary terms, that also makes sense for a parent as well. Yeah. If you're not willing to be there and catch your kid before they make the mistake, well, then your genes probably shouldn't get passed on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so you should learn as a parent.
Exactly.
Because these kids are going to take that chance. They don't see the cliff as a danger.
Exactly.
They're going to walk right over it, so you've got to be vigilant
there.
As a parent.
Even
always.
After they seem like they're going to avoid it when they're crawling. They're going to do it later when they start walking.
Hmm. So you take your kid back there in a minute.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Absolutely. I would contribute to science and have my kid have a good time.
All right, Luke, thank you. Everybody can see Babies on the Brink, as we call it. It's up there on our website right now. It is part of our new video series, The Macroscope, up on our website, which you can subscribe to via YouTube. And we'll be posting new short science films on Mondays. If you subscribe, you'll get those beamed directly to you into your email box. Yeah, that's right. Mondays. You don't have to wait till Friday. You can get them on Mondays. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Luke. We'll look forward to the next one.
Thank you.
One last thing. Those of us of a certain age used to go to the museum as kids and stare at the giant brontosaurus. That was until paleontologists discovered that the giant bones we craned our neck to see actually belonged to an apatosaurus. Scientists decided brontosaurus wasn't its own genus after all. It was part of the genus apatosaurus, so bye-bye, bronto. People kept taking those down in museums. Well, no longer. This week, a team of paleontologists from Portugal and the UK announced that bronto was its own genus all along. That's right, Dino Geeks. That noble thunder lizard is back. Perhaps this is just the beginning. Perhaps experts might restore everyone's favorite childhood planet to its bygone status. So tonight, when you're pondering life's big questions, don't forget to include Pluto, planet or dwarf planet, discuss. That's all the time we have for our lifelong big questions this hour. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you want to hear it again, point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also join our mailing list, download our app, and listen and look on demand. Also, the Macroscope is up there on our website, and you can subscribe to it via YouTube. And if you like us on Facebook. Continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. I'm Ira Flato in New York.